This is Politics with Amy Walter on The Takeaway.
There was this great quote in the old days saying, I'm not a member of any organized party, I'm a Democrat. And we pride ourselves on being the big tent. But turns out, Amy, that being a big tent's hard, right? Because there's people in the tent who say things you don't agree with.
That's
Jim Messina. I'm the former White House Deputy Chief of Staff and campaign manager to President Barack Obama.
And that tension Jim is referring to there? Well, it's been front and center for Democrats all week after freshman Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar said this.
I want to talk about the political influence in this country that says it is okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country. I want to ask, why is it okay for me to talk about the influence of the NRA, of fossil fuel industries, or big pharma, and not talk about a powerful lobbying that is influencing policy?
Congresswoman Omar is referring to Israel there, and her comments were interpreted by many as anti-Semitic. These days, Jim Messina is mostly working on international campaigns, but he sees a parallel between what's happening in the United States Congress and what's happening in the Labour Party in the UK.
Where Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, has refused to condemn vitriolically anti-Semitic remarks. And there's a big war going on in his own party about this. And so these are going to happen. I think what Democrats have to do is remember that we are the big tent and, you know, picking a fight with ethnic groups, any ethnic groups, is not the right thing to do. And when people do that in our party or out of our party, we should call it what it is, which is wrong and ridiculous.
Of course, not everybody sees it that way.
The minute two Muslim women arrive in Congress, they're going to get attacked as anti-Semitic if they're critical of Israel, which they are.
Many Democrats are also frustrated that instead of spending this week promoting their signature anti-corruption and voting rights bill, H.R. 1, they've spent it debating anti-Semitism within their own ranks. Others are frustrated by what they think is a news media obsessed with finding and exploiting any divisions within their caucus to drive clicks and eyeballs. The denouement to this saga came on Thursday afternoon. A resolution that condemned hate against many groups, including Jews and Muslims, was brought to the floor.
I stand as a very strong supporter of Israel.
Hatred for the children of Israel is a very special kind of hatred that should never be watered down.
Words matter. For generations, they have had dangerous consequences for me, for my family, and for my people.
Every Democrat and all but 23 Republicans voted in support of it. Helping us understand how we got to this point and where it goes from here is the New York Times' Cheryl Gay Stolberg.
In 2012, Ilhan Omar, who was not yet a congresswoman, issued a tweet in which she said Israel had hypnotized the world with its evil doings. By the time she was running for Congress in 2018, this became a huge issue. And she wouldn't back down, but eventually, when she got to Washington, she was forced to apologize. But the comments about Israel didn't stop, and shortly after that, put out another tweet in which she said support for Israel was, quote, all about the Benjamins, baby. That was a reference to $100 bills, and many Jewish lawmakers took this as an insinuation that Jews are motivated by money, kind of an ancient, centuries-old anti-Semitic trope. She was forced to apologize for that. Democratic leaders came down on her pretty hard, and Republicans put a resolution on the floor condemning anti-Semitism, and they kind of dared Democrats to vote for it. Since it was a Republican resolution, Republicans don't usually control the floor, but it was a procedural move, and Democrats went for it. They did vote to condemn anti-Semitism. This was about 2 weeks ago. Then, last week, Ms. Omar was at a progressive town hall at a local bookstore and restaurant here, and she tried to explain her early remark by saying that she didn't like the idea that people were pushing lawmakers to pledge allegiance to a foreign country. That was, in essence, a dual loyalty charge. Dual loyalty is a also a centuries-old anti-Semitic trope that suggests Jews are more loyal to Israel or to their faith than they are to their home country. And over the weekend, some veteran Jewish lawmakers were just outraged by this. So they got together and they started talking to Steny Hoyer, the House Democratic leader, and they started pushing for a resolution to condemn anti-Semitism. They wanted this to be on Democrats' own terms. By the time they got to Washington this week and Congress got, you know, back to business, there was an uproar within the Democratic Party. Many members of the Progressive Caucus, which Ilhan is a member of, complained that she was being unfairly treated. She is one of the first two Muslim women elected to Congress. She's also been the target of Islamophobic attacks herself, and they really pushed back hard. And so did members of the Congressional Black Caucus, who said, look, we've been living with racism for hundreds of years. There are black men, you know, getting shot on the streets of major cities by police, and no one issues a resolution. Mm-hmm. President Trump is, you know, saying, you know, making inflammatory, racially tinged remarks all the time, and no one issues a resolution. Why are we issuing a resolution about one freshman Democrat from Minnesota? And why is it only about anti-Semitism? If we're going to condemn hate, let's do it in a big way. So there was a hurried effort to kind of broker a deal between all these factions within the Democratic Party. And that's how we wound up with this far-reaching resolution condemning all forms of bigotry.
And at the end of the day, every Democrat ended up voting in support of it.
Every Democrat did, including Ilhan Omar.
It seems, though, as with so many things, that when you try to make everybody feel okay, you made everybody feel bad, right? So nobody's happy.
That's pretty much right. So a number of the Jewish lawmakers, what I would call the old guard, veteran Jewish lawmakers like Elliot Engel, who's chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, and Ted Deutsch, who runs the subcommittee that oversees foreign affairs, were not happy with this resolution. They wanted a resolution that singularly condemned anti-Semitism. Other people were okay with it. Progressives felt like maybe they had done a good thing and condemned, you know, and making a statement of values. Ms. Omar issued a statement afterwards in which she said it was a historic day because the House had for the first time condemned anti-Muslim bigotry. But I think on the whole, Democrats probably felt like they should never have gone down this road in the first place. And all it did was distract from their agenda.
What does this tell us about the Democratic caucus and Speaker Pelosi's ability to sort of keep them unified as we go forward?
Well, it certainly was not Speaker Pelosi's greatest move. You know, she has had a pretty good rollout, a very good rollout, I would say, after the shutdown, where she really bested President Trump. She came out looking very good. But as Democrats have managed their agenda, there have been a lot of these distractions. And this really stepped on their big agenda item, their kind of signature issue of democracy reform. So I think it raises questions about how well Speaker Pelosi is doing in managing the disparate factions of her caucus and whether she can avoid this kind of thing in the future.
Right. So what happens now? I mean, is the suggestion that should another member, whether it's Omar or others who say or tweet something, that they are treated a certain way, that they are maybe stripped of committee assignments? Like, has a standard been set, do you think, Cheryl? Or is that still fluid?
You know, I think that is the big unknown. What happens if this happens again? What happens, let's say, if Ilhan Omar does say something else that offends Jewish lawmakers? And I asked this question of a Democratic member of Congress, not a member of leadership, but somebody who was very involved in drafting this resolution and in kind of brokering the deal for the all-inclusive resolution. And the answer came back, with a long silence. I think they don't really know. I think she's kind of been put on notice, but I also think that there's a real danger in policing speech. And we saw this at the very beginning of the session when the other Muslim woman in Congress, Rashida Tlaib, used an expletive to describe President Trump. And, you know, Republicans went wild, and Speaker Pelosi was asked about this. And she said, look, I'm not in the business of policing speech. And I asked her, what are the dangers of policing speech? And she said, look, this isn't about policing speech. It's about a statement of our values. And if you want to police speech, let's talk about the guy in the White House. That's a long way of saying, I'm not sure anybody knows what happens after this.
And what does it say, too, about the divide among Democrats on the issue of Israel and how significant this is or may continue to become over time?
Here's what I think is really interesting. At first, I thought this was really about a divide over Israel. And in some way it is, because the progressive left, including many young Jews, are very critical of the Netanyahu government, and Ilhan Omar and also Rashida Tlaib are a reflection of that. But on Capitol Hill, they are really loners. There is overwhelming support within the Democratic caucus for Israel, if not for the policies of the Netanyahu government. And a member of Congress said to me yesterday that debate about Israel is well within bounds, but what he objected to was that Ilhan Omar was questioning the motives of supporters of Israel. And that's a different thing. He said, look, she's talking about us. She's not talking about Israel. If she wants to talk about Israel and its policies, that's fine. But she shouldn't question the motives of the people who back Israel.
Have you ever seen a time where freshman Democrats, we have Omar, you have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Tlaib, sort of defining the Democratic agenda as well as defining the 2020 race in such a significant way?
No, I think they've really taken Washington and the country by storm. And in part, I think that's because of social media. They have huge social media followings. But in part, it's because we had this historic wave of women of color, elected. And I think in the Trump era, maybe Democrats were really ready and hungry for that kind of diversity. And they're smart and they're savvy and they know how to make news.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg, thanks for coming on and joining me.
Thank you, Amy.
It's more than just freshmen in the House of Representatives challenging U.S. support for Israel. Five Democratic senators who are either officially running or considering running for president, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Bernie Sanders, voted against a bill that included an anti-BDS provision last month. This provision allows state and local governments to refuse to do business with companies that support boycotting, divesting, or sanctioning Israel, BDS. I asked Nahal Tusi, a foreign affairs reporter at Politico, why she thinks that the Democratic Party seems to be suddenly becoming more critical of Israel.
A number of things happened. First of all, the Israeli government has become much more right-wing and much more willing to align itself with the Republican Party. During Barack Obama's presidency, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was, in the estimation of many Democrats, disrespectful to Obama, even though Obama put together an extraordinary $40 billion arms deal for Israel. There was a sense that the government there was simply not grateful in any way to the United States under Obama. So this became like Netanyahu just became more and more aligned with the Republicans. And he actually did everything he could to undermine Obama on the Iran nuclear deal, including giving a speech to Congress without notifying the administration ahead of time and getting, you know, any sort of blessing from them. And it was a speech that basically was anti-Obama and anti-nuclear deal. And that really, really upset a lot of Democrats, including, I should add, African-American Democrats who really felt like there was something else going on and that they just did not want to see Obama disrespected this way. Then you have Trump, right? He comes in and he has adopted policies that critics say basically take away any semblance of U.S. neutrality on the issue of Middle East peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. He has moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, for example. He has cut off aid to the Palestinians. He has taken so many steps that are anti-Palestinian that the Democrats have become extremely alarmed, and they feel like the very concept of the two-state solution, which has been U.S. policy for so long, is at stake. And so they feel like they have to do something to right the situation back to what it used to be. In a way, a lot of Democrats who, you know, would have in the past said, well, we're very leftist on this, now say, look, actually, we're the moderates because the Republicans, thanks to Trump, have gone so far to the right.
And how much does generational divide play into this? Younger members and older members?
That's a huge, huge part of it. I mean, we're talking about a younger generation that perhaps does not remember, isn't as scarred by what happened in World War II, the Holocaust, these sorts of things. They don't have the kind of resonance that they once did. Furthermore, you know, there's a lot of frustration with the plight of the Palestinians. It's been, what, 70 years? And the Palestinian side of things has become much more active, much more organized, and much more able to connect with younger people in this country, including, I should add, a lot of younger Jewish people who feel like Israel is not living up to the standards that it should be living up to when it comes to the treatment of the Palestinians. So absolutely, that's a factor as well.
So what's the risk then for a Democrat running in 2020, or what's the bigger risk, that they look too close to Israel and are not supportive enough of the anti-BDS movement, or that they're out of touch with the Palestinians and the plight of people there and the concerns of a generation of younger Americans who say, you know, our policy in supporting Israel is really out of touch with what's really happening on the ground?
I think all of those things are concerns for Democrats who are running, especially ones who have for so long styled themselves as progressives, Bernie Sanders being a good example. Elizabeth Warren is another one who, you know, she's a progressive and she's trying to find her footing on this. A lot of them want to bring it back to this very idea of like, look, we need to put things back in the paradigm to which we, the United States, are someone who can help shepherd in a two-state solution. That should be what we should be going back toward. But at the end of the day, you know, I don't know that the Democratic primary is going to be decided on this particular issue. And there are people working behind the scenes to try to find compromises so that the Democrats don't ultimately hurt themselves in the general election against presumably President Trump, who will try to paint them as anti-Israel.
Do you think that the president or Republicans overall can really exploit the Democrats on this issue politically? Do you think there are enough voters out there who maybe have aligned themselves with Democrats for years who would split with the party over this issue?
It's very difficult to tell. I mean, you have very vocal folks in the Jewish community who are very, very pro-Israel, very conservative. But, you know, polls have shown that most American Jews lean Democratic. And then at the end of the day, how big is that vote? Where are they based? Then there's the issue of donors and funding. You know, certain organizations who support Israel have a lot of sway when it comes to getting people to donate to certain candidates. So that could be a factor that Democrats consider as well. It's pretty unusual for foreign policy or a particular foreign policy issue to be a decisive factor. But when you're talking about, you know, a race where so many different things are in play after years of what's going to be just the most insane news environment we've had in so long, anything could be a tipping point.
I'm wondering how the different presidential candidates have responded to the Representative Omar controversy thus far.
Well, so far she's gotten a fair amount of support. If Bernie Sanders has said, you have to look at this in the bigger context of bigotry and that sort of thing. It's really, really been interesting because originally it seemed like, wow, you know, she has really alienated herself. But then as the days have gone by, a number of folks, including some presidential candidates, have said, look, this isn't just about anti-Semitism. It's also about Islamophobia. It's also about hatred against minorities. And they're trying to use it as an opportunity to stand against bigotry in general.
Do you think they felt a pressure to have to weigh in on this issue?
Yeah. I mean, I think right now, like anything that happens, they're feeling pressure to weigh in on. I mean, I've been trying to pressure them to weigh in on everything from, you know, the U.S. policy in Afghanistan to other things. But frankly, it's still kind of early in the day. Some of these people haven't even declared yet. Some of them are still trying to figure out their positions on some of these extremely complicated issues. And then, you know, they'll give you statements that like try to square every circle and dot every I and take every stand. And you're like, at the end of the day, like, you're like, I don't even know what you believe. But, you know, at this point, that's part of the game, right? Is trying to be deliberately vague to some extent and make everyone happy.
Nahal Tusi, really great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Nahal Tusi is a foreign affairs reporter at Politico. It's not just the Democratic Party that's divided over what U.S. policy toward Israel should be. Many families are, too, especially Jewish families, where there can be a generational divide. We talked to a lot of people about this. Not many wanted to be on the radio, understandably so. It's a fraught and personal topic. But here's one take from Alyssa Rubin, an activist with If Not Now, an American Jewish organization that opposes Israeli government control of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. She says her politics are quite different from her grandfather's.
My grandpa was a teenager during World War II. My whole life, he's told me stories of European Jews who were turned away at the U.S. border and first to return to Europe, where they perished in the Holocaust. He always said, if Israel had existed then they would have had somewhere to go. After Trump was elected, I asked him if he was afraid. He said, no, at least now if something happens, we will have somewhere to go. It won't be like 1939. For most of my life, anti-Semitism was only a thing my grandpa talked about in the past tense. It wasn't until the 2016 election that I saw anti-Semitism rear its head in a way that reminded me of the stories that my grandpa had told about his childhood. The difference between us, though, is that my grandpa sees American Jewish support for the occupation in Israel as necessary for our survival, and I see it as a crisis. And our support for it is the biggest threat to our survival.
We also spoke to both a mother and daughter about how they influenced each other's views on Israel. They did not want to be named. Here's the daughter.
I didn't grow up in a pro-Israel household, though I wouldn't say that the issue of Palestine was of primary importance. As I entered into my undergraduate studies, I made the decision to study Arabic. And I learned more about the region, about its history, about its culture. And I would say that Palestine became something I care deeply about and that has shaped my life and the decisions that I make. I would say that this is one of the reasons why I've had a lot of trouble supporting Democrat candidates in the past, is that I don't feel that these views are reflected in their statements, in their policies.
Here's her mother.
I grew up in a very, very Zionist family that supported Israel, you know, at all costs. But I split with my parents when I was quite young. It was a big, big conflict with them because I've never been a big supporter of Israel. But I think my sensitivity to the real oppression and brutality toward the Palestinians has increased dramatically with my daughter's kind of immersion in the culture and her studying in Palestine. I think it's really important to support Democrats, and I understand that they have to say that Israel has a right to exist, and I agree with that. I just disagree very, very strongly with the kind of apartheid that's going on in Israeli policy right now.
We also reached out to you, our listeners, the Democrats among you, and asked what you wanted to see from the Democratic Party when it comes to its policies toward Israel and Palestine.
My name is Ken Ebert, and I'm from Ballston Lake, New York. As a Democrat, I'm very concerned by what is happening right now in regards to the discourse about the Israeli-Palestinian situation. Overall, I personally would like to see a more balanced view, which includes a critical consideration of the U.S. role in the Middle East and an allowance for an even-handed dialogue.
Palestine is not a country. Israel is a country and is on the front line of many of our battles in the world. So what do I think the U.S. policy should be to the only democracy in the Middle East? I think we should be friendly and supportive, make sure that Israel continues to survive the nonstop onslaught. Lewis Orloff, Florida.
Hi, my name is Liz Ritter. I'm calling from New York City. I'd like to see Israelis and Palestinian Arabs be treated with respect and with a homeland.
You just heard a lot of different opinions, some diametrically opposed. Coming up, we talk about disagreement. The art of it, that is.
It's the Takeaway Podcast. Putin would like to see the liberal world order fall apart.
People of color have always understood that the American dream was a fantasy and an ideal.
There is a crisis of institutional decay in our country.
The risk of sea level rise is going to sink us before the seas ever do.
Us as men, we have to start doing our work.
May your rage be a force for good.
For a daily podcast that breaks through the noise, subscribe to The Takeaway wherever you get your podcasts.